Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. Today, we're going to be talking about a little bit about pharmacology. We're going to be talking about neuroscience and the whole concept of how one designs, uses, and evaluates drugs that can affect your behavior through neuroscience and pharmacology. So, Russ, who's our guest?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Dr. Ruben Gonzalez. He's from the Department of Pharmacology at the University of Texas at Austin. Welcome to Science Studio, Ruben.
Happy to be here.
Well, that's great. Now, before we get into pharmacology, neuroscience, and I know you're a specialist on the sort of alcohol aspects of all this, tell us a little bit about Ruben. How was it you became what you are? What was the driving force, if any, for getting into a scientific career?
My earliest memories are that I was just always curious about everything. The stories that Mom used to tell about how I was, all my other brothers would be playing football out in the yard, and I'd be in the bedroom with a book or something. So yeah, I mean, I've always was very interested in science, and as I grew older and got into school and things, it was more just which science was I going to pursue. And when I got to college, I originally thought I wanted to be a physicist, and that kind of morphed into chemistry, and then eventually ended up in pharmacology.
Where did you grow up, Ruben, when you were reading these books?
I grew up in Texas. We moved around a bit. Junior high in Abilene. Went to high school in Del Rio. Just, you know, city libraries.
Well, I was going to say that I've been reading a wonderful book called Being Texan, which is about how the people from the South actually came here and interacted with the Indians and so on. And those places are quite prominent in the book. And I'm just wondering whether you've had any historical interest in being Texan.
Well, more just, you know, getting in touch with my own cultural background. My grandparents were immigrants. I'm sure you're aware that the generational shift where my parents, even though they spoke Spanish when they had us, the third generation, they never spoke Spanish to us. So I've kind of had to reconnect with
my own. That's the same culture. Thing with me, third generation Italian, and forget the language.
Tell us about when you were an undergraduate. Did you get involved in undergraduate research? I mean, was that an early beginning for you to think about a research career?
Absolutely. When I graduated from high school, I remember, you know, you apply for all these scholarships, and I got one scholarship that was specifically, you know, gave me an opportunity to do research, even as a freshman.
That was at UT?
That was at UT Austin. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, from day one.
In chemistry, then?
It was actually in a physics lab. But as I said, I migrated over through theoretical physics to theoretical chemistry and finally into more basic chemistry and then chemistry of the brain.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about pharmacology and neuroscience and then your particular interest in it. Tell us, first of all, is there a difference between studying pharmacology for liver problems as compared to the head, or is it just another part of the body as far as pharmacists and pharmacologists are concerned?
Well, the basis of pharmaceutical science is how the body works in general. So we all have to have training in basic chemistry, basic cellular physiology. And, you know, so we have to know how the different organ systems work. So at the basic level, the way drugs interact, whether it's with your liver cells or your brain cells, those processes are very similar. Where the differences come up is in when you integrate the responses. So, you know, what does the liver do? You know, the liver helps to process drugs and metabolism, whereas the brain integrates and initiates behavior and thoughts. So although drugs might affect, you know, the liver and therefore change metabolism, drugs might affect the brain and therefore change behavior. But the basic processes of how the drug initiates that action is going to be the same at the cellular level.
You know, we have a company that works on Alzheimer's, and what I remember, I don't remember the chemical, but there's a certain thing that the brain secretes. But the thing that the brain exhibits, dopamine, is it? No, but there's something that's detected, and then it means Alzheimer's on the way, and the sulfonyl fluoride destroys it. So there's a chemical, when you see it, Alzheimer's on the way, and this particular vector, I don't know if that's the right word, we'll destroy it.
What made you choose, you know, neuroscience as opposed to the other, you know, like kidney problems or heart problems? What was the thing that really takes you from theoretical physics, theoretical chemistry, pharmacology, and then the brain?
Again, as a high school student, I guess, you know, these little memories. So I grew up in Del Rio on the border, and my high school colleagues, the popular ones, would go across the border and, to have fun and drink. And I always wondered about it. I just, I wasn't interested in it at the time. And it's just something that was always curious. And then, so this was also back in the 70s, late 60s. And so there was, a lot of free use of drugs and all that, the hippie era. So I was just always curious about it. And so when I got into school and physics to chemistry, I realized, well, I have a good background to actually study this. And I still maintain the curiosity.
Well, were there certain people that influenced you? I know in my career, a similar way, go along and then all of a sudden it might be an individual that makes a difference.
Well, I do also have strong memories of my chemistry teacher in high school. And it wasn't so much that he influenced me in a certain area, but he really, I think he must have recognized in me and some of my classmates that, we were very interested and we were very curious. And so he set up a little lab. I mean, and this was, outside of normal class. This was not a lab class, but he would let us stay after school and he'd take us to his chemistry lab and we just do our own stuff back there. And it was just great fun. So, he kind of like pushed us along. In a sense, yeah, he probably started my love of chemistry, which really is kind of the grounding of what I'm still doing.
Do you go back to high school reunions? I mean, you've been away now 30, 40 years.
I went to my 20th.
Okay, and so the question then, the fellows you remember and the girls you remember that used to cross over the border, to get their Tecates and Coronas, can you recognize them as, you were the ones that were always crossing the border, and then there's this other group. Can you distinguish them in terms of how they've developed?
Oh, not so much. I mean, they're all still great friends.
Okay, so I mean, there was no short, long-term effect of their partying on the other side or partying in
general. I would bet you that if you did a study, those that took a risk and went over the border did better than the ones that just stayed at home and were cautious.
Well, but he stayed at home and was cautious, and he's a great
success. He didn't say that.
Well, he implied it. Okay, let's get on to this whole business then of alcohol. It's so prevalent in all societies. Tell us what your main interest is in this area of study.
So, yeah, again, it's a pretty basic question, and as you said, very prevalent, has an incredible impact on the world, and it's all based on this human behavior of an individual going to get a drink and then consuming the alcohol. So essentially, this is a behavioral issue, and of course, the problem becomes when this behavior gets out of control and there's too much consumption, and then the body starts breaking down and behavior starts becoming erratic, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the basic problem. We don't yet really understand how that happens. We don't understand how even drinking gets initiated. So this is just a basic scientific question.
Or the addictive part of it.
That's another.
Drink too much, the degeneration, we can sort of understand it. But the addictive part, how do we understand that?
That's right. And so that's another part of the question, is that we don't understand how the compulsion develops over time. So those are my questions. Those questions motivate me.
Or how is alcohol different from, opium or something, or heroin, in terms of addiction?
Well, in terms of the ultimate process of addiction, there are parallels, because what ultimately happens in addiction is that the individual loses control over their drug seeking and drug taking behavior, so that whether that's opium or heroin or alcohol. But what happens in the brain that leads to that behavior, we and other scientists you know, like myself, are studying that actively. So, you know, there may be parallels, but I think it's likely that it won't be completely.
So different chemistry, identical. Obviously, right? There are different chemicals. So in the brain, there will be different chemistry. Do we have any hints at all with alcohol, for example?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, with modern technology, you know, over the past 30 years, we've made a lot of progress in terms of, you know, understanding how the drugs affect the brain initially and then what types of things they do after long-term chronic use as well. So one of the kind of key findings that cuts across all of these drugs is that there are clear areas in the brain, in all of our brains and in animal brains, that are involved in controlling motivated behavior in general. And so these drugs alter these parts of our brains. And so, you know, it kind of makes sense that
By motivated behavior, you mean as opposed to just things that we don't really know we're doing or want to do, but motivated gives it some sort of we're thinking this is what we need to do and therefore do it.
That's exactly right. And so the best example of a motivated behavior is when you're thirsty, you go get a glass of water to drink. You know, when you're hungry, you go get food and you eat it.
So with alcohol, I mean, one that comes to my mind is a friend of mine that would go in the bar, have a few drinks, and he was a very nice guy, but when he had a few drinks, he just wanted to fight somebody.
Yeah, that would be an acute effect, what we would call an acute effect. But basically, yeah, what does alcohol do at that moment once it gets into the brain?
Does that imply that the motivated behavior now is to fight, or is it simply that you lack the motivation not to get into those environments? You get the distinction.
Yeah, my interpretation would be that that's the pharmacology of alcohol. So, again, once alcohol is consumed, it gets into the brain and it affects, you know, it changes your thoughts and feelings. And so one of the things that the brain does when it's sober is it kind of filters through the environment and makes decisions about what should I do. When alcohol is present, that filter doesn't work very well, and therefore the actions and behaviors can be more impulsive. And so
in a sense, it removes that social understanding that we built up about what's appropriate and what isn't appropriate.
Right. And so therefore, my view would be, therefore, someone is more likely to get into a fight compared to when someone's sober.
Well, now it's appropriate to take a break. We'll be back. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and Ruben Gonzalez, Professor of Pharmacology, UT Austin. We'll be back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neeson. With all the research that's been done on Alzheimer's, what's been elusive is an early, reliable test for it. In a few years, it's possible we'll have one.
The test is given to someone in their early 70s to determine if they will develop Alzheimer's disease, or AD, with 90% accuracy.
That's remarkable given there's no single test for it, let alone one that's predictive. The test looks at 10 lipids or fats in the blood. If they're low, you're likely to develop Alzheimer's.
Right now, trying to pin down a diagnosis is invasive, expensive, and time-consuming. Doctors can order CT scans or MRIs to look for structural changes in the brains. Newly developed scans are now available at major hospitals connected to clinical trials that look for brain shrinkage, inflammation, and protein buildup in the brain.
Some undergo spinal taps to check for the presence of these proteins. You've probably heard of genetic testing to look at the presence of genes that can increase someone's risk for AD, but with no certainty that they'll actually get it.
Researchers behind the new test had taken blood from over 500 people aged 70 and followed them for 5 years. About a fifth developed AD, and each had low levels of the 10 lipids.
These fats come from the breakdown of neural cell membranes, which are reduced in Alzheimer's. Since testing blood is a routine part of a yearly physical, this test could easily be incorporated.
The question is whether seniors would want it. With no effective treatment for AD, what's the point of upsetting someone? But some doctors argue current medicines could potentially work if people took them sooner, which we can only confirm once we get a reliable early diagnosis.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Ruben Gonzalez from the University of Texas in Austin, professor of pharmacology. And we're talking about alcohol. We're talking about how in different people, different amounts of alcohol can sort of remove those social barriers. Tell us about that a little bit. How does the body, I mean, we all know about alcohol dehydrogenase, and a lot of people from China don't have it, and so they can't drink very much. I've got good friends in Germany and right here in El Paso, very close to us, who can simply drink a lot. Does that mean they have more of these mechanisms for disposing of the nasty parts of alcohol? Or tell us about that.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that's very clear after many years of research. And just to not to be too technical here, but the enzyme is aldehyde dehydrogenase. Ah. That's different.
And so genetically, this is distributed differently in the world.
Right, right. There's genetic differences. And what's very clear and, you know, very well accepted in the scientific community from, you know, very interpretable data is that the presence or absence of these enzyme variants that metabolize, that's part of the metabolism pathway for alcohol, that those affect the propensity to become alcoholic. So for those populations that have this variant that does not metabolize acetaldehyde, one of the metabolites of alcohol, very well, the acetaldehyde builds up when they drink, and therefore that causes an aversive reaction. So they're less likely to drink, Asian populations in general, whereas the European populations don't have that variant very much. Those populations tend to drink more, and so it matches perfectly. So study after study has shown that's
you know, makes you wonder whether it's an evolutionary effect. There was a lot of drinking here, so this thing developed over time, you know. I guess we don't know the answer to that, but
yeah,
it's
we don't know
an
the
interesting
answer
question.
Carry on the thought process, though, that is there a way that the body sort of after time gets programmed to produce more of this dehydrogenase the more you drink if you're capable of making it in the first place?
Well, alcohol consumption may affect, and I'm not sure about this, but in general, drugs are known to affect the production of different enzymes. But I don't believe that that's a big issue in this case. I think it's, you know, what's in your genes is,
okay.
It depends on, you know, which one it is and how much of it is produced.
So you can't train yourself to drink more.
Right, right. And not through this mechanism that I'm aware of.
So let me ask this question. It seems to me I remember that there was something they were giving alcoholics in treatment, Anabuse. Is that right?
Right.
Does it work? Is it still around?
That's another great question. There are not very many drugs used that are approved in the U.S. to treat alcoholism. That was the first one, probably 50 or 60 years old. It's still available, as from my understanding. So the way it works is it blocks this enzyme that we've been talking
about. It makes
you
sick if you
drink. Right, and
when
you drink, you get sick. So it works that way for sure. But the problem is it's not been shown to be an effective treatment for alcoholism because the patients will just simply stop taking the drug.
Yeah. So, but that brings me another question, which you just alluded to, and it seems to me, as I look around, it's becoming more and more difficult in the United States to get drugs approved. And that leads to what looks to me like a non-competitive system in the United States vis-a-vis the rest of the world in terms of developing things like you're talking about.
Yeah, so that's more of a political regulatory question. I think one of the problems in terms of developing drugs to treat alcoholism, it may be more of a market issue.
Well, for example, here the natural health people say that they're being really massacred by the FDA and so on because they've known for 1,000 years that this herb will help you or something. And it just seems like a problem in moving forward in some of these treatments.
Somehow we need to promote more research in this area so that these treatments can move forward.
And you've got to have some proof that they work.
Right,
I mean, there are an awful lot of over-the-counter supplements that they tell you they've got, and I don't know ingredient X, well known by the Incas to do activity Y. And then when you actually measure it, they don't have any.
Right.
Because there are no regulations.
Well, right? That's because the FDA doesn't recognize Inca medicine. Come on.
That's right, right. We have to have proof,
you need
controlled
regulatory
studies.
Controls.
You need
okay.
controlled I studies mean, to prove that, that right. they work. Otherwise, the FDA won't.
Now, one of the other things that no governments are doing, they're trying it in Britain, and they certainly have done it in Russia, is to stop alcohol being so cheap. I mean, it's amazing when you go to Moscow and you know you can buy vodka, and it's cheaper than water for sure. And in England, you go to any supermarket and you can get some generic beer, a lager, always a lager, and it's incredibly cheap. And so the government's now making rules and regulations and says, hey, if you're going to sell these alcoholic beverages, this is the minimum price that you must charge. So
yeah,
talk
yeah.
about that. I mean, it's,
so,
it's a social
so again,
science.
Right, also. Right, right. There's so these are policy issues. It's not my area of expertise, but my understanding is that, yeah, there are studies that have shown that availability can be changed through policy decisions, and these do affect then, outcomes. For example, fights in bars. So, again, I can't cite you any specific studies, but studies like these are going on, and my understanding is that they show that there are ways to deal with the problem through these mechanisms.
And the underlying point, though, is that this is a true role for government to interfere, if you like, with the marketplace,
right.
All right, in order
right.
to have a more viable and sane, if I could say that, society. But not everybody agrees with that.
You know, the U.S. was the site of one of the biggest experiments with prohibition. And you know, many people may not be aware of this, but during prohibition, it was what? 10 to 15 years, I don't remember the exact dates, but the data clearly shows during this period, liver disease went down dramatically in the United States. So it helped the population. Of course, you know, we got the mafia and all that stuff.
Well, it's very similar to the drug situation today. The studies that show we ought to turn drug addiction into a health problem rather than a legal problem, it seemed correct to me.
These are policy, political questions. You know, I study how brains affect how drugs affect the brain.
Tell us a little bit about your latest discovery in that general area. I mean, in lay terms, but you can use technical terms.
So, as I mentioned earlier, one of the main questions that I'm pursuing is why do people start drinking in the first place? So, you know, we have a naive individual, individuals that's never had alcohol. So, generally, adolescents. And at some point, they take their first drink, and they continue to drink after that.
Well, I remember my grandfather used to give the kids a little bit of wine and water.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So my question is, what's going on in the brain that leads to this continued behavior? And the way I view it is, from an experimental standpoint, you have a brain that's never experienced alcohol before. Then there's a first experience with alcohol. The drug gets into the brain, changes the brain, and those changes become more or less permanent. In terms of the individual then begins to seek alcohol and consume it voluntarily after a single experience. So my experimental question is what's happening in the brain during this process? And so what we do is we are looking at brain chemistry, and so to do these studies, we use rats and mice. And our latest finding, which is still unpublished, we're preparing the paper. So what we do is we train rats to drink a sugar solution. So they'll go back and get it because they're naturally attracted to sweet solutions.
They're sort of addictive too, huh?
Well, it's a vehicle to get them to drink in a regular spot. Then one day, this is just after a few days, then we give them alcohol. It's about the equivalent of wine. And the first day, they're very cautious and they drink a little bit of it, but they don't drink that much. The very next day, they go back to it and they get drunk on it. And so what we found is that comparing day one to day two experience with alcohol is that this area in the brain that we know is involved in motivated behavior, we were talking about earlier, it has changed so that the first day that they drink, there is little or no response of this particular neurotransmitter called dopamine that plays a critical role in how this area of the brain works. On day two, so this is, again, their second experience with alcohol, the dopamine response spikes. There's this huge response. And it occurs right when they begin drinking. This is showing that after a single experience with alcohol, the brain has changed in a significant way that we can measure the changes in chemistry in this area that controls motivation. So we think that this change in chemistry is tied into the change in behavior.
When mice and rats take alcohol, do they behave in a similar social way? Are they more combative with each other, or are they more amorous towards each other? I mean, how does it...
We don't really know the answers to that question because we, in a laboratory, well, it's not that we can't do it, and some of my colleagues may be doing it, but yeah, so these are more social questions. So you need a large group of animals that have more natural behavior. What we're looking at is, an individual rat in a particular experimental setting. So
one sip, and that's all it takes.
Well, they drink more than a sip. They drink enough to, we think, feel the effects of alcohol, a mild experience.
That's it. I mean, we've run out of time. We really didn't get into this very much. We squandered a lot of time talking about things we don't know anything about.
But it means you have to come back to Science Studio.
So, Ruben Gonzalez, thank you very much for being here on Science Studio.
A pleasure.
And I would like to say thanks. Please come back to Science Studio. And also another topic, drink red wine every day, and you won't have any problem with your heart.
Yeah, thanks, Ruben. Thanks, Russ. Thanks, Norma. And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. The Medical Center of the Americas Foundation has launched a capital campaign to support construction of El Paso's first ever biomedical research building. The $37 million facility will be the first structure on El Paso's first biotech park, also being developed by the MCA Foundation. Read more at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from Kindred, a transitional care hospital.